I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the House Public Safety Committee today, March 30, 2006. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Cornish.
Here.
Ellison.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Johnson. Messel.
Here.
Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman.
Here.
Tamar.
Here.
Soderstrom.
All right, members, let's move to today's calendar. We're going to be going probably a little out of order. First of all, just an announcement. The first one that we have, House File 3278, Representative Lanning, he's requested a continuance, so we'll pull it off today's calendar and see what transpires between now and Tuesday. We will, for our first bill then, take up House File 3235, Representative Pepin, Vulnerable Adult Criminal Neglect Penalties Created. Representative Pepin, welcome.
Mr. Chair, would you like to, do you need to move it for consideration in the omnibus bill?
You beat me to the punch, Representative Pepin. The Chair will move House File 3235 and for purposes of your presentation and then lay it over at the end for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Pepin, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3235 was pretty simple. It simply creates new penalties for the crime of neglecting a vulnerable adult. You might recall that I was before the same committee last year with a similar bill, which the committee was kind enough to include in the omnibus bill, and I appreciate your support on that. But because some concerns were raised by representatives from the nursing homes and the hospitals, I withdrew my language at that time. House File 3235 reflects compromise language and limits the scope of the bill. It simply says that a caregiver who has responsibility for the care of a vulnerable adult as a result of a family relationship may be convicted of criminal neglect and may be sentenced as follows. One, if the neglect results in the death of a vulnerable adult, the caregiver may receive imprisonment for not more than 10 years or payment of not more than $20,000 or both. And two, if the neglect results in substantially body harm or the risk of death, to imprisonment for not more than 5 years or payment of a fine of not more than $10,000 or both. Members, this legislation is needed because currently there is only one penalty for neglect of a vulnerable adult, and that is a gross misdemeanor punishable by not more than 1 year imprisonment or a $3,000 fine. I don't personally believe that's acceptable. Last session when we heard the bill, Captain Greg Rail of the Brooklyn Park Police Department testified to the committee as to why he felt the legislation was needed. I don't have Captain Rail with me today as he was busy, but I do want to talk a bit about why he brought this proposed legislation to my attention. And this may seem familiar because he did tell about it last year. But an incident happened in his jurisdiction in which an adult caregiver who was charged with taking care of his elderly mother neglected her when she fell. He brought her food and water, but he did not move her. She sat in the same spot on the floor for more than a week, and she sat in her own excrement. When the authorities were finally notified, this caused her to go to the hospital and spend several weeks, I believe, in the hospital. And in the end, the fellow was found not to have any sort of, you know, mental disability or any type of situation for doing this. And he was given probation. That's all he got. Members, the penalty for mistreating animals is currently greater, as unbelievable as it seems, than the penalty for mistreating vulnerable adults. In fact, Ms. Curious, I believe, gave me a chart last year which says that in current statute, the maximum penalty for mistreating an animal when it results in death or great bodily harm and is done to and threaten, intimidate, or terrorize another is a felony of 4 years and $10,000. I hope you see the same disconnect that I do. So if you mistreat Bowser, you could be charged with a penalty and a $10,000 fine and up to 4 years in prison. But if you do it to your own mother, the most you can get is a $3,000 fine and not more than 1 year imprisonment. So my intention here is to toughen up that section of the law. Last year, the difference is I wanted to include all caregivers and operators, so it would have applied to the nursing homes as well, and the nursing homes and hospitals had some issues with it, and I think some of the issues were legitimate. And I view this as compromise language, and I would appreciate your support, and I will stand for any questions.
At this time, are there any questions from the committee members? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, what are the legitimate reasons why a caregiver who is an operator would not fall under the felony provisions, but a caregiver who is a family member would?
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman. Well, my preference would be to have those included as well. Perhaps it would be a better question for maybe Mr. Lips from... Oh, you're not with the nursing homes anymore, are you? Okay, Mr. Lips. My understanding is they were worried about the fact that nursing home workers are frequently low paid, and if they had to worry about the additional penalty, perhaps they're working with a number of different folks, and if they had to worry about, additional penalties, they would have a harder time attracting people. That's my understanding. My preference would be to include all of them, but since I couldn't get that to and move forward last year, this is a limited in scope, but I'll let Mr. Lips maybe address the question as well.
Sir, have a seat at the table, identify yourself, and address the question that Representative Newman was posing.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is John Lips. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota, which is a long-term care trade association, and would be testifying today also on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, which is a coalition between my organization and the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. Representative Newman, we had expressed concern with the language as it was introduced last year, primarily because there was no element of intentionality that went along with these increased penalties. And so our concern was that there could be instances where a caregiver would make an honest mistake, would make a judgment in an instance of delivering care, and as a result could have been subjected to much higher penalties. Because we don't have the language of the bill from last year, it's difficult to walk you through that analysis. But that was our primary concern. It was a concern that was shared by the Minnesota Hospital Association, a representative of the Minnesota Nurses Association, and others. And as we discussed it when the bill reached the House floor last year, there was also concern among some members of the Health Committee, Health Policy Committee in the House. And as a result, Representative Pepin decided to wait until this year.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick follow-up comment, Representative Pepin. I would direct your attention to Subdivision 1 of the bill, which speaks specifically about intentional neglect. I would also indicate that it would be my understanding that for any felony, intent would be an underlying element of a crime. So I would not agree with the testifier's representations. I really don't see a distinction as to whether or not you commit an act which causes the death or great bodily harm of someone, whether you are a relative or a caregiver. To me, it, in either instance, it would be a crime that would rise to the level of a felony.
Mr. Chair and Representative Newman, I'm with you. But I would like, seeing as how that language obviously wasn't acceptable to enough members of the body to pass, I feel that this is what I can move forward at this time. I would agree because the language did talk about, from last year that I have, it clearly says intentionally neglects a vulnerable adult. And you're a lawyer, so you would know more than I on that. But that was my feeling as well. But, this is a compromise. I feel we can move forward. And at least in home situations, I feel we can make a difference. But thanks for your very astute observation.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Oftentimes, what is practical is good policy. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I have, thinking back to my father, the end of his life, chose not to go in a nursing home or in the hospital, chose to die at home. I guess the question I have, how could this affect a person who's following the directives, the care directives that a person has priorly done? I mean, at the end, they're probably considered a vulnerable adult, and actions that by not maybe giving the medical care that they would get in the hospital could result in their death because that's at the point of their life. How could this affect a person in that situation? Are we interfering with people's end-of-life decisions?
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Newman, I sort of hate Representative Nelson, I hate to venture a guess with all the attorneys on board here. I think many of them would be better equipped to answer. My understanding is that wouldn't, I mean, this is very limited in scope to intentionally neglecting a vulnerable adult. And I maybe perhaps one of the attorneys, maybe Ms. Perius, wants to answer that.
Ms. Perius.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, there are exceptions in the statute for that. So if a vulnerable adult or a family member has made a decision of that nature, it would be an exception from this rule.
Representative Nelson.
That gives me some, that calms some of my fears, but it's just a concern of the nationwide stuff that's going on with people interfering in the life decisions of some people. I guess that's just the concern I have. Like I said, having gone through that with my father 30 years ago, I guess it's just it's a concern I have.
Representative Maslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, I remember last year the efforts that you made to bring this forward and the challenges that it came that came with that, and I know that was a frustrating time. I appreciate that you've put it in front of us again. I can certainly support everything that's in here. I would agree with Representative Newman that, ironically enough, the only debate in my mind is whether you've gone far enough, but I'm happy with everything that's here.
Is there anyone present in the room that wants to be heard on this matter, House File 3235? Please raise your hand at this time. I see no one. Any further discussion on this bill? Representative Pepin, thank you for your presentation. The chair does lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Meslow, let's take you at House File 3648, Policy for Death Scene Investigations. Want to give us your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My motion would be that House File 3648 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill.
Thank you. Representative Maslow, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that almost can be read as quickly as it can be summarized, but it boils down to two portions. The first one is that it directs the Department of Public Safety to provide information to local law enforcement to assist them in handling death scene investigations. And the second is that it talks about the procedures that need to be followed in those investigations. And the focus on Subdivision 2 is to make sure that the human remains can be identified and returned to family members as quickly as possible. So it handles those two pieces. I will say that I learned yesterday that the Department of Public Safety has some concerns about this bill, and I'm not sure if there's someone here to testify against the bill. I had heard that might happen today, and I'm certainly very interested in listening attentively to any unintended consequences of this particular bill. Otherwise, I'm prepared to field questions.
Are there any questions at this time from the committee? Is there anyone present in the audience wishing to be heard on this matter, House File 3648? Please raise your hand at this time. I see no one.
I will then, Mr. Chair, assure the committee members that I will continue in dialogue with the Department of Public Safety, and if there are concerns that at the time we're actually considering our omnibus bill, I will relay those to committee members so that everybody can be clear on that.
Thank you, Representative Maslow. Chair then lays the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Members, we are going to take Representative Kahn next, and she's on her way from another committee, so we'll just wait in place for a moment.
Mr. Chair?
Where? Oh, Representative,
could I ask Representative Meslow a question if we just have some time?
this Representative Meslow, where is he? Will you yield for a question from Representative Eastland? He has a...
Well, you don't have to go there. It was related to your bill, and it wasn't that critical, so I didn't want to hold up anything. But if we are waiting, just waiting here. I
haven't had the chance to answer enough difficult questions yet today, Representative Eastland, so I welcome the opportunity.
I understand that probably better than most in here. How often is this an issue? I mean, I guess I'm just kind of, you know, I mean, this is kind of morbid stuff, you know, but I mean, how often is this kind of stuff an issue, and what's the, what happened that prompted the need for this kind of stuff? I mean, are people hoarding remains, or what's, I don't know, what is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, this actually, you'll recall yesterday I had a bill that I was, that had been brought to me by Senator Ortman. This initially was combined with that in a single bill, and so it was something that, as a result of some attendance at a national conference that she had had, where she had seen some comparisons of different ways that states had handled it, that this seemed to be a worthy direction for us to head in Minnesota. So it wasn't so much identifying problems that had occurred as it was comparing what we have in statute to what other states have in statute, and seeing that it might be advantageous to learn from the other states, from some other states on that point.
Thank you, Representative Meslow. You're dismissed. Take your seat at the. Sorry, Representative Hillstrom. I think we'll go to you next. You're here. House File 3849, local correctional fees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move that House File 3849 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill removes the requirement that a person must be sentenced in order for a local correctional agency to impose a fee for incarceration. As more and more people are placed in the custody or not necessarily sentenced, but diversions occur, there creates some issues with the ability to collect fees. So with me is Ron Wyborg, and I'd like him to speak to the issue.
Go right ahead, sir. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Wyborg, Hennepin County Community Corrections. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity today. Last session, there were modifications made to Statute 244.18, which basically covers pretrial release, continued for without prosecution, basically diversion-type actions by the court, which still requires supervision on the part of the local correctional agency. And these changes to 244.18 allowed us to charge that fee without the client having to have been convicted or sentenced, because we still have to supervise them. What we want to do here with 60912 is we want to further clarify the language so there's no conflict with 244.18. By removing the word sentencing, we won't have a conflict with that 244.18 language, and also it'll take care of any stay of adjudications that we get. This does not in any way affect the authority of the court to sentence. It doesn't affect the court's ability to do anything. All it does is clarify that for people who are placed either by the court after conviction or prior to even being convicted, and we have to supervise them, we can charge them a fee. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. So that's about it.
Any questions of this witness from the committee? I don't see any. Is there anyone in the audience wanting to be heard on House File 3849? Please raise your hand at this time. No one. Any further discussion? Chair lays the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you both. Representative Kahn, you are next since you're here. House File 2673, police to notify organ harvesting agencies when body of an organ donor is found.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before you start, is there a motion on the bill? Representative Hillstrom.
I would move that House File 3849
Is it going to be laid over?
I think so, yeah. Yes.
Be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very good. Representative Kahn, the bill is before us. Go right ahead.
Is that the right number?
Longer. Oh,
2673.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, this a handout is going around which will show the members of the committee what was the inspiration for this bill, which is that I spent Thanksgiving in Oregon with my kids and grandkids who live there, and I read the copy of the Eugene Register Guard on November 24th, and read about this program, which apparently came from Washington State Patrol. You know, and I've worked, and I know other people have also worked on enhancing our donor, the donor designation that's on the driver's license, and making sure that it means something, and also making one of the things that I had first discovered working on this very early was that in general, when there was a problem in the when someone got into an accident, the first thing that happened is that their wallet and driver's license was separated from the person, so that the fact that you had written donor was often never known in the hospital where that decision might be being made. And so one of the things that I've worked on in the past was making sure that that was looked at and so forth. But anyway, reading this article in the Oregon newspaper, it apparently one of the places there was a hole in the program was that many people in automobile accidents never go to hospitals, they go directly to the morgue. And with improvements in donor availability in the kinds of things that are used for donation, and you know, there was a large waste, in a sense, of people who wanted, we're only dealing with people who had already indicated on their driver's license that they wanted to be a donor. And so I think if you look at the article, if you look at the article, you see before the Oregon State Police launched a new donor notification this month, only the families of people who died in hospitals were offered the chance to save a life by donating vital organs and tissues to people in need. And again, I don't know what the... I assume we're not that much different from Oregon, but that only accounts for one-third of all deaths in Oregon. And there's... And so the inspiration actually was with a longer Washington State Patrol person. So there is a letter coming, which we thought we got in the mail and we didn't, but from LifeSource, which is the donor coordinating office. I did have discussions with the post board, and they would like to have Section 3 deleted, and I agree that that's not necessary, and so there's an amendment if someone would move it to delete Section 3.
Representative Kahn, okay, if you want that amendment moved. Representative Hillstrom moves the H2673A1 amendment, and I believe Representative Kahn has described that amendment adequately, but is there any questions on the amendment? If not, on the amendment, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the bill is amended. I believe that solves the post issue, and is there any need for testimony from post on this matter at this time? I see them shaking their heads. No, thank you for that amendment. Any additional presentation or questions at this time? Representative Messel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, there are references in that in the new language to the person's dispatcher. Can you just tell me what that means?
Well, that's anyone who's this is referring to law enforcement.
Okay,
on that. So it's not, this is not done by, you know, the person sitting in the car also. This is done by the law enforcement person and so if you look back at paragraph D, clause 1 refers to the law enforcement officer, firefighter, paramedic, or other emergency rescuer. Originally, when I first read the item in the Oregon paper, I think I had originally asked it to be written that person was the notifier, but it was pointed out that you know, first thing that person has to do is make a call to their dispatcher, and then that person needs to stay, he thinks, at the scene of the crime, so, not the crime, at the scene of the accident, or whatever it is. And so then the dispatcher then takes off from there. And all that, they don't have anything that they have to do except notify Life Source, which is the organ coordinating in the state. And then they then put everything that they would put into place. So there's right. No, it's like one extra phone call from somebody who's not at the scene of the crime is all we're requiring.
Representative Mess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I'm okay with the responsibility. I'm trying to figure out who it is. When I think of dispatcher, I'm thinking of the person who's answering the 911 calls. But I don't know if by dispatcher that means this is the person who is physically in possession of the body, transporting
no.
it to the next place. What by dispatcher, do you mean the person answering the 911 call? Is that who it's
I
supposed
mean,
to be?
Whoever
who
that
it?
Person, I mean the person who, well, I guess I don't know what I mean. I mean, it's the person who's in charge of the person who's answered. I don't know if that's the same as the person who's doing the 911. I think the 911, person answering the 911 call doesn't do the dispatching. Person answering the 911, as I understand it, person answering the 911 call calls somebody who then does the dispatching. So it's the person that, and so the person who's at the scene has somewhat that they report back to as to what's happening, and it's not the person who made the 911 call. I'm sure, I believe this is probably, if this passes, that the motion is probably going to be that it's held over for inclusion in the omnibus
right.
bill, so I'm sure we can find out whatever that is. But
Representative Messel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Don, that would be my intention. I like what you're doing here. I'm just not sure that we're clear on who it is that we're saying has that responsibility. So if we can just work with that and make
okay.
sure that we've got the right language for that.
Chairman,
Representative
Meslow, all I want to say is that somebody who knew something,
okay.
as opposed to me, changed it to dispatcher when I had originally had the person at the scene doing it.
Right.
So
you.
I assume there's someone who knows.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Anyone present in the room wanting to be heard on this bill, raise your hand. There is no one. Any further discussion? If not, the chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative
okay.
Kahn.
Thank you very much.
We're waiting on some copying on Representative Peterson's bill. Then we'll call next House File 3931.
Welcome, Representative Smith. If you want to make your motion on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House File 3931, and when we're done, ask you to lay it on the table for possible inclusion. So I would move the bill. Also, we do have an amendment, A3 amendment, and if you'd act on that now, then I will present the bill and describe what we're doing.
Okay, you want to, we have the A3 amendment before us in House File 3931. Do you want to speak to the amendment?
I think, let's do this. Let's just shift gears. I'll describe what we're doing, and I've got Janet Marshall here to further describe and or answer questions. The bill before you, Mr. Chairman, repeals outdated statutes relating to county and municipal courts as a result of trial court unification. It moves language into Chapter 44. It amends the statute to reflect that there's a new governing body of the courts, being the Judicial Council and not the Conference of Chief Judges, and removes some other outdated language. Again, I've got Janet Marshall here if you want further description.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Marshall, would you state your name for the record and proceed with your comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Marshall from the State Court Administrator's Office. I think Representative Smith gave the short answer and the only answer for what this bill is before you. Believe it or not, this big bill is nothing more than a technical bill. For those of you who have been around the judicial branch for a long time, you might recall that prior to 1984, we had two levels of trial courts. We had the district court, which heard only upper-level criminal matters and civil matters over $10,000. And then in Hennepin and Ramsey County, we had a municipal court, and they heard the lower-level civil and criminal matters. And in the other 85 counties, we had county courts, which were responsible for juvenile, family, probate, and lower-level matters. In 1984, the legislature amended the statute to say that each judicial district could vote on combining the district and county courts. That happened over time and was accomplished by 1987. And we finally decided it was time to go in and take the county court statute, the municipal court statute, get rid of the sections that were no longer needed because they were duplicative of the district court statute. And those sections that were needed, we were simply moving over to the district court statute. And that's what the bill accomplishes.
Okay, so just going back to the A3 amendment, is basically technical in nature. It was the oversight of the revisor, as I would understand, and so it's an author's amendment, and so we will just incorporate that into the bill at this point. That's where we are. So,
thank you.
House File 3931, is there a question from the committee on the Cornish's question? Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, members, the question I had is on the A3 amendment when we're additional employees. How is that handled now? The sheriff of a county shall furnish to the district court deputies to serve a bailiff. Is that an agreed-upon contract? Because in my old county where the judge was always aggravating the sheriff, ordering the sheriff to bring people here and there and ordering to buy clothes for the defendants, and it really got under his skin because he wasn't budgeted for it. But how is that coming to agreement now when they said shall serve? Are they compensated for that, the contract between the court and the sheriff, or how is it?
Representative Smith?
Ms.
Marco.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, this language actually is in existing law, and like I said, we're just moving it from the county court statute over to the district court statute. And in general, each county has different arrangements with the courts on how they accommodate the statute.
Sounds great. I just was wondering if it was establishing newer.
No.
Any other questions from the committee? Seeing no further questions, the chair will lay House File 3931 as amended over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Chairman, thank you. Representative Peterson, would you step forward? And you're on House File Quadruple X. Representative Peterson, the committee does not have possession of the bill, therefore it's before us on an informational basis. So there won't be any motion allowed or necessary, but it's before us on that basis, so go ahead.
Thank you very much for hearing this bill, because I think it's a very important one and one that just recently came to my attention from a constituent. And we have, in addition to the bill that we put before you, we have a redrafted, not even retyped, copy that you're going to get. And this is one that was drafted using our language, but it was redrafted with us by Eric Lippman, who's the state sex offender policy coordinator, and also Jerry Kerber, who's from the Minnesota Department of Human Services, healing this. It's probably a little more legalese and probably drafted in a form that is acceptable, at least to the folks who would have to implement this kind of legislation. Now, I have with me today Cynthia Sanga, who is the person who has had intimate workings with this particular issue, and so I've asked her to testify, and with that, Cynthia.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Cynthia Sanga, and 4 years ago, a 34-year-old woman went on a regular Head Start home visit, and what happened in that home began a 4-year battle that has led to my being here today. Corrine Parker was outside the range of her cell phone when she went into that home, and when Head Start father made an inappropriate sexual comment that really frightened her. She got out of the home safely. She went back to her Head Start agency and she said, "Was I just in the home of a sex offender?" And her employers told her, "We aren't going to tell you. You can go find out as a private citizen. But if you find out and say anything to anyone, we'll fire you." So as a Head Start coordinator, she learned that, she was in the home of a level 3 sex offender who spent time, who was a felon, and who was considered to be a danger to any child from age 5 to a young adult. She was in a program that had young children and young adults. And she went to her employer and she said, "They need to know." They told her that his rights to privacy trumped the parents' right to know that they were interacting and their children were interacting with a level 3 sex offender. She told her sister that, yes, her sister's suspicions were correct, that the man that she thought she recognized in the community notification 2 years earlier was indeed a level 3 sex offender. And her sister went out, got the profile, and started handing it out to parents in the parking lot. She said, "These parents need to know." And after the parents learned of it, they started coming forward with stories of, "Yes, he walked out of sight with my child last fall. You know, the photo album that disappeared when he left the group last week reappeared when he reappeared the next week. He's been taking pictures of my little girl. And the one that disturbed me most is one mother came forward and said, I was really bothered when he was watching my little girl go to the bathroom." And Head Start administration said his rights to privacy trumps the family's rights to know that in their midst was a level 3 sex offender. 3 weeks later, the day she went to the director's office with her supervisor told her that she was one of the best Head Start home visitors they'd ever had, and she loved her work. Then she walked into the director's office, and he told her she was terminated. That was 24 hours after she had asked for a policy change where parents could know that they were interacting with a level 3 sex offender when it occurred. He said, "We're not going to change policy. The father has a right to privacy. Data privacy prevails, and you're out of here." They posted her job the same day she asked for a policy change. Our notification law almost worked in that case. It allowed the community to know. The community almost remembered it for 2 years. And the only way that that community notification law failed is that the employer was able to step in. Because Corrine Parker, knowing that she was risking her job, she let the parents find out that they were interacting with a level 3 sex offender. And he has not done anything, to our knowledge, since then. In the public scrutiny, he was not bothering parents by his activities. He started conforming. That's what the public notification law seems to be about. And it worked once the knowledge was out there. But it cost Corrine her job because the law says that the sheriff must notify the agency, but it doesn't have any flow-through to the people who need the protection. This amendment would allow that to happen. This would allow the parents and the children who are most vulnerable to know when they're among someone who's a predator, the most dangerous predator. So I respectfully request that you help protect those young children in education programs who are not getting the word about our most dangerous predators. Thank you.
Are there any with that, we would ask if there are any questions.
Representative Peterson, do you mind if I ask Mr. Lippman to come to the table? I have a question, and that is, what does the amendment do or not do that the bill does? What is missing from the bill or added to the bill by this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Eric Lippman, the State Sex Offender Policy Coordinator, and I apologize in advance for the penmanship or lack thereof. As I understood Representative Peterson's concerns, what she was interested is in making sure that if there were a level 3 designation of an offender who was participating in a Head Start program or in a daycare program as a parent, that information could not be barred by any facility or program policy from being distributed to parents. If she understands the case of Corrine Parker versus Lakes and Pines Community Action Council, that's 805-953, a decision of the Court of Appeals in February of 2006, where, as Ms. Assange described, the employee made claims that she wanted to tell the parents about the level three that was a parent being served by the program. The facility refused, and Ms. Parker made hostile work environment claims and also reprisal discrimination claims. The Court of Appeals disagreed for the reasons described in the opinion. And what Representative Peterson would like to do is be sure that local programs could not bar by their own privacy policies information that they receive about level three offenders. I think the language tightens up and makes clear who does the notice, and that this doesn't implicate either a new background check procedure, which was a question that we raised when we originally saw the XXX language. And again, I think really focuses clearly on the transmission of information that is known to the program administrator. I hope I say that correctly.
So, Mr. Levin, the intent of the author then, at least by the bill, the intent of the author seems to be that if a level three sex offender is minding someone's children, that that the parents are so informed.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I may, I think that scenario is less likely, in the sense that a level three sex offender is not likely to be cleared from the background check. If you work either as a volunteer or as an employee providing what is known as direct contact services, you are not likely to be permitted to work as an employee or as a volunteer in the daycare setting. The harder case is that a level three offender, as described in the Parker matter, had children who were being served by Head Start. And so because they're drawn to the program, because they're participating in other events, because they may well have access as another parent being served to children, that may well be information that should be disseminated amongst other people in the program. I think that was the problem Representative Peterson was aiming at. And again, we were focusing, again, as a drafting exercise, to say, if you receive notice under, from law enforcement that the level three is there, that you can, and indeed shall, transmit that downstream to other people in the process. As I understand the facts of the Parker case that Ms. Stanch described, they knew that this was a level three offender. Indeed, it's on the website, but they interposed their own company policy as a barrier to distributing that information downstream. The argument I understood from Lakes and Pines Community Action Council was, your status as somebody receiving Head Start benefits is private information, and notwithstanding the fact that you're highly likely to reoffend sexually, we can't link you up with receiving Head Start services. I don't think that was ever the intent of the legislature. I think it's a potentially dangerous situation that Representative Peterson would like to address. I hope that my garbled penmanship is clear and is technically accurate. We were moving a little bit on the fly here.
So, Mr. Levin, then, the people that you referred to as being downstream getting this notice, do they, under this amendment, do they get it just as fast under this amendment as they would have under the author's bill?
That's true. In the author's bill, there was a 36-hour provision, and that probably didn't get in this amendment. Perhaps as we go, Mr. Chairman, members, towards the omnibus bill, that might be a useful addition, which is, again, one of the features Representative Peterson was interested in was within 36 hours, and that certainly wouldn't be objectionable. I think the key part is, if the facility or program knows, they should share it with the other parents. And that clearly, I think, is consistent with the intention of broad community notification.
We have Representative Soderstrom, Eastland, and Hillstrom. Representative Soderstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Peterson, I just thank you for bringing this forward. This is my district, and I did hear about this. Corrine Parker called me, and I knew that she was going on and taking some legal action against Lakes and Pines. I would like to know from either of you, the situation that she called me about was the fact that she's a Head Start worker, and she has worked there for a long time, was a good worker, and they said that. But the fact that they could send her out alone, because these these workers, they go into these homes, and they had sent her out there without telling her that this is a level 3 sex offender. And is that still possible, that that could happen again? Because I thought that was, it just seemed very wrong that this person shouldn't be notified that their client or their family was that. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative, since Cynthia Sanga has had intimate contact with this case for over 4 years, I'm going to ask her. She probably knows.
The initial drafting of the bill had staff notification as well. I think if the parents are notified, the staff will find out. So at least the staff will go out there notified of it. Should the staff go into level 3 sex offender's home with someone else? I know after that incident, Ms. Parker surely wanted to. She did not want to go out there alone again. That seems to be an issue outside the realm of this. I think knowing about it is an important step. That Head Start agency said that they would send her out there alone again, and that if she couldn't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. Do we want to include that in this notification bill? I'm not certain.
Thank you. Thank you. And I was very surprised, too, that they said that this was privacy and they couldn't tell their employees when they were asked to go into a home where the man was a level 3. So very interesting, because I'm a realtor. I sold the house to this level 3, and it was like a week later there was this big community notification. So I do know the whole situation there. Thank you.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lippman, maybe you can answer my question here. It says when a daycare facility or other program receives notice under Section 244.5, what is that? What is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, that's the level 3 notice. So if they get a flyer that we're having the community meeting, or if there's if they go to the community meeting, or if the sheriff has developed a notice about the level 3 offender, frequently it's a fact sheet, that all that information can be shared with people participating in the program.
Okay, then my follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Do those fact sheets automatically go to daycare centers and those kind of things?
I think that the best practice is that if there's a daycare center or a facility like this within the range of the community notification, that law enforcement should indeed drop off a flyer. It may well even be more public than that, which is we frequently see them run in the newspaper, we see them on radio ads, there's public comment in the media, and again, I think if there's a fact sheet developed, that should be disclosed.
Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at that and saying what we're saying is we're assuming that anybody that runs a daycare center facility or Head Start or whatever is going to be perceptive and be looking for that kind of stuff, and so the burden is kind of on them to find out as opposed to requiring that kind of information be passed on to those kinds of services. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, if you go from the new paragraph J, 3 lines down, receives notice. I think the idea was that if you were aware of the fact, that you were obliged to transmit it, not that you had an independent duty to search out, do daily checks of the level 3 website.
Well, then, Representative Smith, how would this have changed that situation? In this case, the Head Start people did know. What is the issue here? Okay, but it is possible that the Head Start administrative group, whatever that is, would not know, and there still is no process in place that would say, well, they should have at least be informed. But
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, I think the intention is that you couldn't interpose company policy as the reason for keeping that data confidential, which is, we know he's a level 3 offender, but he's one of our Head Start parents, and that's more private than the fact that he's highly likely to reoffend and may well be present a public safety risk to the other people in the program.
And I have one final question.
Representative Eastland.
Would this, how would this affect a Head Start program's willingness to accept a child from a family that it would have a sex offender in it? I guess that's just a kind of a unrelated question in one respect, but I guess just a comment.
May I address that?
Sure.
Yes. From what I understand from the depositions and the four-year litigation struggle, Head Start said they have an obligation to accept every child, and they intend to do so. So I think the Head Start policies are in place, the national ones. This is a 100% federally funded program, and I think the policies are in place to protect the child going in there. What we want to do now is protect the other children.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is for Mr. Lippman. I'm going to call you representative, sorry. I'm interested in the language that we move from in Article J to the new language. It appears as if we went from an employee and a volunteer to a participant. Did you say that that was because people now with background checks are not likely to be an employee or a volunteer?
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we actually, coming in here, had an amendment to add participant. So it would be an employee, volunteer, or participant, because we felt that was left out of the language.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I believe that an employee or volunteer have been deleted from the section. Isn't that the new language just talks about a participant?
Mr. Smith, a representative, yes, because normally they have background checks before accepting that kind of work. In most facilities that happens, and they're required to have background checks before they engage in those kind of activities. But participants are a different creation.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lippman.
Also, as members may well recall, in Chapter 130, it was in the special session bill. It's in Chapter 4 of the first special session bill of last year. The addition of, it was 136, so forgive me. In House File 1 last year, we added all the criminal sexual conduct crimes, 1 through 5. And so if you are, a level 3, it's likely that you have one of those crimes. The commissioner may not exercise his or her discretion to make you an employee or a volunteer in those facilities. You're permanently barred. Now, there's some legislation this year that would backtrack on that. We're working on that in another forum. But as the law is currently under House File 1, if you have a criminal sexual conduct crime, you cannot be hired as a employee or a volunteer in these settings to provide direct contact services. So I think that the employee risk is fairly low.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lippman, very, very quickly, the language regarding the immunity provisions under Subdivision 7, if you know off the top of your head, would those immunity provisions in this case have protected the employee from being terminated? Is that what that is driving at?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, and perhaps Representative Peterson can explain her intent, but as I understood the language, if there is disclosure by the program of this information, we don't want the level 3 offender saying that they, their expectations of privacy have been interfered with in any way. And I don't think it's a viable claim, but just so as to make it clear, because this information already is posted on the website, we don't want them to have frivolous or not meritorious claims against the program for disclosing this information. They're under a duty under the Peterson bill to send this information downstream. We don't want to subject the daycare to claims for doing that conduct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Thank you. So is there any language in here that would protect the employee from disclosing this language? Because the whole point here is this employee did that and got canned. Is there language in here that would protect the employee?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I just had word that, yes, that does protect the employee, too. I don't know what from Subdivision 7.
Okay, so
Mr. Chairman, I guess one argument, and I think it's actually accurate, Representative Newman, is that in the Parker case, one of the claims was that the disclosure of this information was not a statutorily protected duty, that she wasn't obliged under the statute to share this information. I think that there's a better argument if there's a duty on the daycare to transmit this to parents, that if the employee did that, that they were doing something urged by statute. That's an argument that wasn't available in the Parker case, would be one going forward and might be a contribution to the law.
Thank you, Mr. Lippman. One question to the chair. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us to hear this. It's sort of a new twist on sexual predators that, frankly, I hadn't really thought about. As I understand it, this is being heard for informational purposes. Can you tell me, if you know, what's the status of it? Where's the bill? And are we going to hear this for possible inclusion?
Representative Newman, let me try to answer that. But by way of doing that, Representative Peterson, are you going to introduce as a bill the revised language, and or have you introduced anything at all on this?
We would use the revised language and had it all drafted, but have not introduced it.
Okay. So is it your intent then to introduce your bill with the revised language?
With the revised language, okay. Yes.
Representative Newman, I guess when she does that, when the representative does that, it'll be referred to us, and I'll request that it will be, and then it will be before us. We can consider it then at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Representative Soderstrom for a final set of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lippman, I just would like to know if it's legal or acceptable to ask that sex offender when, like, Lakes and Pines goes out or he applies to them for use of their, they must certainly ask some questions, like, where do you work or what do you do or a little about the family. Could they ask him if he's ever been prosecuted or whatever, sex offender, or he's a felon or something?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Soderstrom, I think the answer to that would be found in the Head Start regulations, and that's far beyond my area of expertise.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at this, and we've had a lot of talk about daycare centers, Head Start centers, but it says a school, daycare facility, and I'm thinking school. Could that be high school, grade school? I guess the practicality is what I'm looking at, the broadness of that. If would this school, say a high school, have to tell every incoming student that Sally over here's father's a level 3 sex offender and have to have that notification to hand out? I mean, I'm just looking at that practicality of that. Are we going too broad with this? Or, I mean, I'm all for notifying about sex offenders, and I understand that part of it, but I'm just looking at that practicality about it. We're putting a burden on maybe on the schools that every new student, I mean, if you have some of the inner city schools and even schools in my district, a third of the students change over every school year. So if as long as a student is there who's a father or parent is a sex offender, we'd have to have a duty to notify every incoming student and family. Maybe I'm reading it wrong, but that's...
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think if you, again, starting from the new paragraph J, and with regret, you'd have to count down 7 lines, the second from the bottom, whether the offender is participating in programs. So I think it's the distinction between level 3 sex offender sends daughter or son to school, which would not be participating in, the offender is not participating in the school, as opposed to having the offender, perhaps make, build the sets for the school play. That might well be a different... or is volunteering as a driver ed teacher or is assistant coach for the football team. I think those are different levels of contact and ones which may well be of concern where you'd want to share that information.
Any further? Mr. Lippman, I believe I heard you testify that you're working on a bill elsewhere that would give the DHS discretion to allow level 3 sex offenders some work in care facilities. Did I hear that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Berglund has a bill, and the number escapes me. I think it's Senate File 3013. I don't want to be quoted. I could certainly get you that information later. And it's on. It's received a second reading on the Senate floor, which would permit, except for home-based delivery of care services, the personal care attendant, the person giving adult foster care where the provider lives in the home, you know, situations like that where there's a person providing services in their own home, except for that situation, any other licensed professional adult foster care or other health care setting, that she would permit the commissioners to set aside earlier criminal sexual conduct convictions, murders, first-degree arson, a wide variety of crimes, to bring us to the pre-House File 1 set of laws. In the governor's judgment, the reforms enacted last year are very sound policy, and indeed, in his judgment, don't go far enough. But Senator Berglund's bill, which is on the Senate floor, would unwind all of the work that was done last session and presumably permit, indeed instruct, the commissioners of health and commissioners of human services to get back in the business of assessing whether this or that murderer, this or that serious sex offender should be permitted to provide direct contact services.
I'm sorry, Representative Peterson, I'm getting far afield here. However, mm-hmm. I don't get to see you enough. Is there a House...
I feel exactly the same way, Mr. Chairman.
Is there a House companion to this Berglund bill?
Mr. Chairman, members, there is a House companion, not to that language. The Senator Berglund's bill, the original, as introduced, started out a much more modest plan, which Representative Abler has now pending, awaiting hearing. I can give you that number as well. A very different, much more modest plan before the Health Policy and Finance Committee. His plan is very different and not nearly as concerning. And we're working with Representative Abler on his language as well.
Okay, well, why don't...
If I can consult my notes, I can send a note up of the House file numbers. You can make an announcement.
You can, well, get us that information after the hearing. We can disseminate it. I guess I can't think of any reason why we would want to retreat from what we did in House File 1 on this particular issue. But we'll see.
From your lips to God's ears, Mr. Chairman.
Anything further, Representative Peterson?
Other in closing, just to say that, as you know, I have been both an early childhood teacher as well as high school teacher, and I think it's our duty to protect children from level 3 sex offenders. Any kind of contact that would be, they're very vulnerable, it could be very damaging, and I think it's our duty to make sure that that doesn't happen, and I think this kind of language will at least go a long way to helping protect the most vulnerable of our young children. Thank you.
Representative Peterson, get your language introduced ASAP so we can have it before us, because time is running quickly and we'll be building our omnibus bill in the next few days. So,
thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your time and both of you witnesses. Committee, is there anything else?
All right.
Nothing further to come before this committee. This meeting is adjourned.